days. Well, welcome to episode 23 of the Behind the Curtain Ministry podcast. This is a podcast where we do try to go behind the curtain of what it's like to be in ministry leadership. Something I like to do is talk to pastors, authors, musicians, athletes, really people in the spotlight who are followers of Christ, and talk about what that's like. I know for myself, as a church planter, as a pastor, as a wannabe author, someone trying to get out there in the author world, there is a lot that goes into this insecurity stuff of being in the spotlight and the persona of it. And what I try to do is bring in guests that I know are vulnerable people and transparent, and a musician that I have respected and really loved the music of for many years is Derek Webb, and he's our guest today. I want to read you his bio as we get started. What you hear in the background is Derek's song, Mockingbird, and you can check out DerekWebb.com, which I did recently, and purchase his video of this album, which I definitely recommend. It's pretty awesome. I'm going to be reading Derek's bio straight from his website. Derek is a 20-plus year veteran of the music industry. Derek has sold millions of albums as a founding member of Texas-based folk rock band Caveman's Call, and ruffled political and spiritual feathers alike as a solo artist. He is also co-founder and president of the revolutionary tribe-building platform Noise Trade. Derek, welcome, and thanks so much for being here.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
So I noticed on your bio, on your website, you don't have your Dove Awards listed.
Did you notice that?
I did. Yeah. Wikipedia told me otherwise. Your real identity is still out there.
Well, there's nothing you can do about that, I suppose.
So I obviously say that tongue-in-cheek, and to kind of follow up on your bio.
Yeah.
I was looking for a relevant magazine article from 2006. I was a subscriber, and you know, you were on the cover, and I was trying to find that article, and I couldn't find it. But correct me where I'm wrong on this, because I'm pulling from a 10-year-old memory of reading
it. Yeah.
Did you switch musically from Caveman's Call and the CCM scene to solo work because of restrictions about kind of being told what you had to write in order to get on the radio? Is that in the ballpark?
I think that's fair, but I would say that whatever restrictions I might have been responding to these are not things that are actually written out somewhere. I mean, it's more like, you know, I think the reason that I made, there was like, a bit of a tension or that I started to feel as, I was kind of hitting that 10-year mark with Caveman's, where there was just subject matter that I really felt like was important to engage and talk about and give some voice to and some soundtrack to that seemed kind of unaddressed and yet really important, like in the kind of church world that where we had made most of our living. And and I definitely, I mean, it felt like gnawing on the hand that feeds you a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I needed to bring the stakes down. Like I felt like there were some things that to me felt really important to talk about and address with the music that didn't feel worth staking 10 years of the band's reputation and work on my bringing those issues up.
Yeah.
But they definitely felt important to bring up. So it's like, it just felt like I needed to prepare myself by bringing my spiritual, emotional, relational liability lower, you know, like lowering the stakes so that if I got, like I needed the platform to be smaller so that if I got knocked off, it wouldn't hurt as much.
Yeah.
And I could rebuild it quicker because Caveman's has spent 10 years building that career. So it didn't feel fair to drag them into some risk that for me felt really important. It felt life or death.
Yeah.
And for them, they understood the importance of it, but it wasn't really, it was just that feeling of being called out of one thing and into another.
Yeah.
And they really intuited that as well. And so they were very supportive of me doing it.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. What you did was really, really hard. It was a really hard thing to do. And that's kind of where I want to focus our time. I mean, there's a lot of excellent interviews with you out there that I'm going to actually link to about some of your music and art and even Noise Trade.
Sure.
Kind of what I want to do with our time together is talk about this from a ministry leadership perspective. You're at this crossroads and you had to pick which way you were going to go. And I think it's easy for me. For example, one thing I vividly remember in that 2006 relevant article was your Mockingbird tour. And this would have been the article is 2006, just for listeners. So Mockingbird came out in 2005. People are walking out of your concert when you're singing about Jesus not being a middle-class white Republican. That would be the song, A King in a Kingdom. And as I read that 10 years ago, I'm 33. I was 23 when I reading that. I was in the first year of my church plant, and I'm like, yes, go get them, Derek. You know, like, right. 10 years later, I think about that and think, man, like, what was that like? Like, there's a part of that had to hurt a little bit, right? I mean, can you talk about and I tend to ask too many questions at once.
No.
So feel free to answer what it was like for like the Derek of 10 years ago and then the Derek of today, because I know from your Mockingbird video that you have on your website right now, your little trailer there, you talk about that guy 10 years ago.
Yes. And
you like him, but you don't, I'm kind of paraphrasing here roughly, but you don't always agree with his choices. You admired his enthusiasm.
Right.
So what did that guy feel when people are leaving the concert, because of these things you're saying? And what do you think about that now?
Yeah, well, so let me say this. I mean, like a lot of artist friends of mine and just a lot of people I know in general, it's a common personality trait. I think it's probably more – It's the vast majority of people have this thing about themselves where people call it, it's like people pleasing, like
absolutely.
They care a lot about what people think and that it really bothers them when people don't like them or misunderstand them. And it's this thing that a lot of people have. I just don't have it. And let me be clear.
No, I hear you.
But let me be clear. I have other problems.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that like
I'm envious of that. Like, let me just say that right now.
Well, but I have other problems. Yeah. I really, I'm saying, and I'm not saying that that's not a problem. It is. Yeah. It can be. I mean, I think there's a healthy expression of people pleasing that where you care about people. I think compassion can be the healthy side of a people pleasing instinct. But I just don't have it. And I never have. I don't have that part of my personality that really cares what anybody thinks or is bothered when I'm disliked or misunderstood. I've just never had it. I can't explain why, but I just don't. And so I have to be honest that the more of the struggle for me over the years has been when there are moments when it's where being disliked or misunderstood is required to do the work well. Which on a record like Mockingbird and on most of my records, because I'm wired this way, that has tended to be the trend. And for that reason, it's not really been hard for me to watch crowds get up and walk out of shows when I'm singing certain songs. If anything, that's the encouraging part for me. That's where I'm like, okay, I know that I'm doing my job. That exact response is why I am here. Like that's what I'm doing here. So if people just sat, like I don't mind people standing up and applauding, and I don't mind people standing up and leaving. What I do mind is people just sitting and not listening and not being engaged.
Right.
I just want a response.
And
I don't care if people in response to what they hear in the songs, I don't mind if they disagree and wind up more firmly set in their opinions they held before they heard the song. And I don't mind if it shakes them into rethinking the position they had before they heard the song. I don't really have an intention either way other than to engage people.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm wired that way, the struggle for me is to try to not enjoy it too much when it happens, honestly. because I remember the show that you're referring to and that I think was the story I was telling in that interview back then. And it was basically, like I was playing the Mockingbird songs, but it was, most people either had just gotten or didn't have the record yet. So people didn't know the songs yet, but they knew they were coming to my concert. And I had two other records out and all my Cademan's songs that I would be, that I was playing. And so people would come to the show and they really didn't know what they were in for during that particular tour. Cause I was playing all the Mockingbird songs before they'd really heard them. And I was in some church in Texas and I played A King in a Kingdom. And yeah, I watched like a third of the auditorium get up and exit by the end of that song. And at the end of the show, the promoter kind of, I came off stage, the promoter came up to me backstage and he was just mortified and he was just,
right.
He was like, oh, I'm so sorry. He was so apologetic. And he was like, this is the worst. I'm just so embarrassed. I'm so sorry this happened. And I looked at him and I was like, dude, this is the best night of my life. Like, like that couldn't have gone better. Mm-hmm. Like, are you serious? Like, don't apologize. Like this, that was the best. So I'm kind of, which is kind of why I take that part of my artist, the work I do as a songwriter seriously. Like, you know, I don't make music for everybody and I don't make music for every season of someone's life. Like you don't always want to be agitated, but, but I'm good at it.
Yeah.
And I don't mind doing it.
Yeah.
And I'm primarily do it in an effort to agitate myself. Like the thing to be clear on is regardless of what the collateral damage is in terms of other people, I am always the one in my crosshairs. Mm-hmm. So like I'm coming after me, like I'm coming after those parts of my personality that have tended to be out of line with what I believe to be true. And as I do battle with those parts of my own personality, the people who resonate clearly just have things in common with me, but I'm not coming after anybody else. I'm coming after me. And as I'm telling that story, you know, I think some people have, you know, I've at least seen folks kind of accuse me of being like really, really critical of like the church and really critical. And that may be true, but only because have always considered myself part of it.
Yeah.
So in as far as I'm part of it, I guess I'm criticizing the church. That's like saying you're coming down so hard on humans. It's like, well, if by that you mean I'm a human and I'm coming down on myself, you know, like you're coming down really hard on 40 something white males.
Right.
It's like, well, I'm a 40-something white male. I guess you're right, but I'm unintentionally hitting everybody else. I'm intentionally hitting myself. And so it's like, and I think to sum it up, I mean, there's this great quote. I've spent a couple of different albums actually on some very particular subject matter, the idea of living peaceably, the idea of not exactly, I don't like broad terms that I know like 10 people have 10 different definitions for, those kind of words do nobody any good. But the idea of like, you know, loving of enemy, let's say, I mean, that's a really hard, bit for me to swallow. And I am such a fighter. And so I don't do that well, I don't do it easily. And I have two records and it's really touched on every record from Mockingbird on has gotten into that territory a little bit of the love of enemy. And two records, Mockingbird and the follow-up, The Ringing Bell, were both really intensely about that subject. Mm-hmm. And people have asked me about it. And there's this great John Lennon quote that I love explaining that with, which is, he and Yoko Ono were asked about their intense protest of the war, and the Vietnam War. And there was just, you know, the bed ends and the, like all these, you know, their big Christmas billboards about war is over if you want it to be and that whole thing. And they asked John Lennon, like, what is it with you and peace? What is it with you and the idea of peace? Why is that so important to you? Why are you like staking your whole career and reputation on this idea? And he said, because I know myself to be such a violent man. And I think that's such a good answer. He wasn't just criticizing politicians and soldiers. He was saying he knows himself to be so violent that he has to protest war because he's constantly waging war, emotionally, relationally, in every place in his life. And I know myself to be such a violent man that the things that I spend my time addressing in songs and in lyrics are not things that I feel like I have some keen prophetic eye to try and correct everybody on. It's things that I am intensely struggling with and I'm basically putting myself in the crosshairs of. And if there's blowback, that's unintentional on my part, but that was not what I was aiming for. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. How would you, let's say, take that answer as an artist and musician and as a ministry leader, at least someone, you know, in the spotlight. And I think, you know, ministry leadership can be defined different ways, but I would call what you do ministry leadership, in that you're teaching, you know, you're teaching through lyrics. Mm-hmm. How would you translate that to someone, let's say in my shoes? I like to just get advice from people I interview, but mm-hmm. someone who's a pastor, or in my case, I guess I can say author. I'm not published yet. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get a book published and blogging and these things. And I particularly blog on things intentionally that are controversial and things the church doesn't like to talk about. So with mm-hmm. that, I want to read just another lyric I wanted to read on the recording, but this one is from Rich Young Ruler from Mockingbird, would have been saying at that same concert as people were walking out, but come on and follow me, but sell your house, sell your SUV, sell your stocks, sell your security, and give it to the poor. And those who know, mm-hmm. Jesus's teachings know you're basically giving a modern day translation of like the message, so to speak, of Eugene Peterson. You're doing right. that in a very provocative way for our culture. I don't think I could preach those things you said from mm-hmm. you know a pulpit, mm-hmm. And maybe I should. You know, I'm not sure, and so I'm wondering if you could just give some advice for pastors listening, for pastor types who are authors and are writing. How do we, those of us who do struggle with what people think of us, and oh, does this person right. like me, and that kind of right. eats me up, and yet I want to be faithful to what God has told me. I mean, is there help you can give us along those
lines? Well, here's what I can say is, as an artist, I definitely have the advantage of coming in and out of those kind of situations. Yeah. Whereas in your position, you don't get to, like, I get to come in like a bull in a china shop and then I clear out and it's kind of your mess to clean up. Like, right. And I realize that. And that's an advantage that I have. And it's one that I take advantage of, when I can, because there are those moments where you can dismantle a lot and disrupt a lot quickly. And that's good. That can be good. Those can be good moments for people, but obviously you couldn't do your job that way. Someone mm-hmm. who's in a permanent vocational local role, you can't do it that way. That like, you know, and even if we're all trying to accomplish the same thing, ultimately, maybe, I have the way that I have a liberty at, you know, by which I can do it. And then, the responsibility of somebody who's always there and is going to stay. Yeah, that's different. And so what I would typically say is like a good rule of thumb for me is like, and this is a little bit of a broad answer, but is that where I've seen church done well, in my opinion, in my estimation of what its purpose is when we gather is, or when people gather is, that church should look and feel more like an AA meeting than an Amway convention. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if you go into a church and it feels like everybody's kind of puffing up and trying to sell you something and trying to advertise themselves as being something or project something, I think that really confuses. It's extremely confusing. It's a really mixed message, as opposed to somebody getting up and saying, "Hi, the leader getting up and saying, "Hi, my name is so and so, and I'm an absolute wreck and a mess, and I'm an mm-hmm. addict, and and come with me and let's all go get healed. You know, like come with me and let's all go get recovery together. But we're all exactly the same. We all need the same stuff. So, in my opinion, leading with vulnerability and with being, as I've heard somebody once say, the chief repenter, you know, or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, like leading with that, I think is a really good way to do it, because then it does kind of give you the ground where it's clear that you're saying the same thing I'm essentially saying, which is whatever I'm going to ask of you and whatever I'm going to say to you, or whatever way I'm going to guide you, just know that this is primarily advice from my own heart. Like I'm not asking you to do things that I have mastered. Mm. If anything, I'm probably worse than you are at these things. And so this is a thing we're going to do as a community, just because I'm up here telling you, maybe just because I'm the most self-aware in terms of how bad I am. Maybe that's why I'm up here and you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm up here and you're not because I need to be the one more transparent than any of you really can be because someone must model this. But unfortunately, what my observation is that the church tends to be more obsessed on, church leaders tend to be more obsessed on looking like Jesus than looking like they need Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's a totally different posture. And I think that church leaders feel as though it's their responsibility to look like Jesus all the time.
Right.
But really, that's not it. And you don't see that modeled really anywhere. You don't see Paul or Peter, any early church leader, prancing around trying to pretend that they're the savior. If anything, look at what's documented. It's horrible. Like, these guys were horrible. Like, these guys just falling all over themselves. And their whole leadership style was, look how much we need this, not look how good we are at this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's hard. I get, but I really think that's kind of the only way you can approach it and do it well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that does. That's helpful. And I, that's usually where I get into hot water, and it's usually on my writing side of things, approaching that. And then it's typically people in my church who will have a problem with something that I wrote. But that's a very helpful synthesis of those two things, for sure. And so back to this, something I'm curious about for you, and some of this is, I am sensitive a guy. I wish I wasn't, and I tend to beat myself up. And when I get beat up, when I first started in ministry, the criticism didn't bother me. And the compliments didn't really affect me. I didn't really need them either. Now what I find is that the 10 years in or whatever, 12 years in, the criticism bothers me a lot more, and I know it shouldn't. But the compliments are a lot more helpful as well.
Right.
I was struck by, when I say compliments, I just mean like encouragement.
Yes, right.
Like, hey, keep writing that stuff you're writing. Keep saying that stuff you're saying. So your song Reputation, it came out in 2004, which would have been pre-Mockingbird. Like really, I think pre all your controversial stuff. Like when you were just getting started with...
Other than my first record, which had Wedding Dress on it, my debut record kind of came out with a bang. But yes, you're right. But that second record was a little quieter, and that's where that song's from. Yeah.
Okay. So in that song, you said, a couple lines, and I know you wrote these lines 12 years ago or longer. But I've got a reputation with everyone, but I don't want one with you. And then in the same song that you say, I lost all my friends. Mm-hmm. And I just am curious, like, as you look back, were you getting beat up during that time? I mean, was there, as you made, was it the solo, moving to solo? Was it moving away from CCM? I mean, not to throw anybody under the bus, but
what was
it like for you personally? Were you losing friends? I mean, were you getting beat up during that, during that period?
I don't recall there being any response that was not predictable from anybody. I typically have a pretty good sense before I put something out there of exactly the response I'm going to get and exactly who I'm going to get it from.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not usually surprised.
That's helpful.
I'm not usually surprised by the negative response. I am sometimes, as you said, surprised by the support and surprised by the positive response. So sometimes that will be surprising, where I'm not expecting it, but I'm always expecting it to be as bad as it typically winds up being. And I've run into that many times in my career, but I think at the time, honestly, like, that was that particular song, I think, was like maybe one of those more, and I kind of drop these here and there on all the records, and I mix them up in such a way that it's hard to tell the differences, I would imagine. But that was like more just one of those kind of more like just personal, feelings I was having of like because of something about the way I'm wired, like I've never been really, it's taken me into my 40s to like learn how to be a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
And to learn how to be vulnerable in such a way that really builds real friendships and real community around me. And I've always been horrible at that. And I've always been like a real lone ranger. And I've not grown up having a lot of friends. I've had very few. And I think I've, you know, learned over my life to be sparing with my vulnerability and things like that. And And because I'm wired in that way to not really need people's approval, I think that that's maybe the shadow side of,
okay, yeah,
of a personality trait like that. It can be good. It can make you kind of brave, you know, to say certain things and not be concerned about the fallout and the response, but it can also make you a little insular and a little unknown to people. And, I feel like it was me kind of working some of those things out, you know, mm-hmm. I'm just kind of feeling like I, at that point, felt like I just had been categorized by a lot of my friends as being a certain way. And I didn't like that feeling. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's not a good feeling to feel like people have kind of passed their judgment on who you are and the way you are. And for people to kind of write you off in such a way that they are essentially saying, I am going to take no more new information about you from here forward.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter how you might change or wish to change or actually change or evolve as a person or grow. I'm taking no more data in to revise my opinion about you from here forward, which essentially means people kind of write you off. And as I was observing that happening, I feel like that's where like lines like in a song like that would come from, is saying like, that seems to happen with me. I feel like I've behaved in such a way with certain people where they just are no longer interested in learning anything new about me. They just think they've kind of got me figured out and they're not really paying attention now.
Yeah.
And that's hard. You know, it makes it hard to like, cause you want people to revise their opinion. Like, I'm not the man I was 10 years ago and I'm not the man I was 20 years ago. I'm not the man I was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's like the friends you really love are the ones who are willing to stick with you and continue to observe you and take in fresh data, fresh intel, and revise, always hope in you and revise their opinion of you. And that was something I feel like I wasn't seeing a lot back then, for whatever reason. And so that's why something like that might've landed on that record. Yeah.
Well, that theme, it really hits home with the theme of this podcast and even some of my own struggle, where this leads me to this article that you wrote for your Facebook page, Relevant, mm-hmm. reposted it. And I just encourage people to read it. I'll link to it. Derek Webb on Failure Liturgy and New Year's. And the quote in there was about this friendship thing. You're reflecting mm-hmm. on this very difficult season of your life, the last few years. And it says, for most of my life, and certainly as these events transpired, I've been dramatically under-resourced with people around me with whom I've been truly vulnerable, who really knew me. Mm-hmm. That seems like a common theme for people in the spotlight, people in leadership. And I am wondering, as we kind of wind our time, I want to make sure we talk about that before we're done, because
sure.
I think you just have such a unique perspective on that. I joke about behind the curtain, you know, you don't really have a curtain in your music. You're so vulnerable. But then in your personal life, you know, you're saying the opposite. And I do think that's one of the reasons people fall, people fail, is because we just don't have those people. And it made me think, like, I'm 33 and I'm looking at my church and I'm looking at my friends and I'm like, man, my really tight friends are from college, like before I was a pastor. And I still have a couple of those that I can be real with, but we don't live together. You know, we don't live in the same state even anymore.
Right.
It's hard for me to develop that type of friendship with people in my church, but then I feel like I don't have time to develop it with like pastors or people outside of my church.
Right.
Can you reflect on that in your own life? And maybe just kind of, we can end with maybe some advice you have for ministry leaders. In that article, you are so adamant about the need for that. And I want to preach that as well here with this interview, that we as ministry leaders need friends like that. How do you get friends like that?
Yeah, well, I think it's just all too easy for people who make their living in front of people, who are like literally living out their story publicly, mm-hmm. be that an artist or somebody in a leadership position like you're talking about. And I think you get to where you start to, almost like the way that most people curate their own Facebook pages,
you
get to essentially choose what people know and choose what you reveal. Even my own songs are just the bits I've chosen.
Yeah.
These are calculated risks for me. They always have been, you know? So it's like, even those bits are things I've chosen for people to know. And there's a lot of bits I've not chosen for people to know that you just don't know are there. And you, and most people maybe think they really do know the people whose music they listen to or whose stories they hear anecdotally from a pulpit. You know, like, well, you're hearing the safe bits, you're hearing some of the bits, but I think it's tempting for, the fault does not lie with the listeners, is what I'm trying to say. I think that the temptation is for people like me or like anyone who's in those sorts of leadership positions to believe that your job is done when you've chosen to be vulnerable in a calculated way through your work. And you feel like, okay, I'm doing my job of being known. I'm doing my job of being vulnerable. And especially when you feel like you're kind of laid out emotionally like that, where there is that emotional liability that you're kind of taking on, you kind of tend to, in every other way in your life, the pattern that I've observed with my friends is you tend to maybe sometimes be a little insular and closed off, mm-hmm. because you do kind of make your living being in the public. And so you kind of choose to do it there. And then I think the temptation can be to be extremely private and even have secret things, you know, mm-hmm. beyond that, because you feel like, well, I'm sharing all the time. And so, so beyond that, I really want to close off, and I don't want people to know, and I don't want people to. And so it just gives you, it kind of, when you're tempted to believe that you really are sharing yourself with people and being vulnerable and people are knowing you, when you're doing it by way of your vocation in that way, it just maybe it causes a lot of people to, without even meaning to just kind of go underground with those things that they would not wish for people to know about themselves. They just take that underground. Mm-hmm. And that's a real trend I feel like I've seen, which is why sometimes then people can, you know, things happen. You didn't see come. You have no idea. There was this whole part of their lives. And so for me, I've wound up looking back and being grateful for when it's come to a head, because it really does force the issue of having to find those people. But here's what I can say in terms of the last question you asked was, how do you find those friendships? And here's what I found is there is, like, most of the time you meet somebody, you get to be friends with them. You meet somebody and you connect with them because you have something in common. You're in a particular life stage together. There are things that you like that are similar, or you have, there's some reason why you're compelled to meeting somebody. And it's usually good things, like you work together, you have common interests, you have common friends, whatever it is. And then over time, maybe you learn more challenging things about somebody, or they learn more challenging things about you, and it tests that friendship. Well, here's the difference. Pretty much all the friends I have at this point in my life, having gone through some hard years, are the friends that I have now. When we got to be friends, the first thing that we learned about each other, the first things we learned about each other were the worst things, mm-hmm. because of the nature of the timing of when we got to be friends. Because it was like the kind of friends you make standing on the deck of the ship are different than the friends you make flailing, trying to grab people from drowning on the side, off the side of the ship.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you learn the worst things about somebody as the first thing you know, or when they learn the worst things about you as the first thing they know, well, those are friends you kind of have a pretty decent sense are not going to leave you, because there's no surprise. There's not going to be some horrible thing they're going to learn about you later that might really risk the friendship. Because in fact, the friendships I have that are like this, as the friendships have developed, based around the first things we know about each other being the worst things, it's almost kind of surprising and delightful to learn good things about each other. Mm-hmm. You're like, well, I had no idea you were such a whatever, good bowler, you know, whatever it is. And like, I had no idea that you were into Brazilian jiu-jitsu and you're like a brown belt. How did I not know that? All I know is that you're a complete failure in your marriage, you know? And so it's like, it's a whole different type of friendship. And so the people in friendships I have now, so what it does is, if you're not forced into those kinds of friendships, if you either didn't get pushed off or fell off the side of the boat, and now you're trying to grab people in the water to keep from drowning, if it's not if you're not forced to find friends and share that way, then it has to be a choice that you make, which is much harder. It's easier when it's out there, mm-hmm. and you can't help but people knowing the worst things about you. Well, now every friendship you're going to make from that point forward is going to have to be based on people knowing the worst things, because everyone knows the worst things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, that's not the ideal way to do that. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that.
Not the model. Okay, I'll write that down.
But yeah. If that's not the case for you, your need for those kinds of friends is no less.
Yeah.
And so what it requires is a big calculated risk, which is to identify a couple of – if you're a man, find a few safe men. If you're a woman, find a few safe women who you feel as though – and it's something you do carefully and cautiously, but find just a few people who you can enter into some kind of a pact with to say, let's get all the dirt on each other where we feel safe. Let's really tell each other our whole life stories, and let's find a few people with whom you can tell everything and you can share. And I mean everything.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that doesn't need to be, and maybe shouldn't even be your spouse. Sometimes you really need those additional people in your community who your spouse knows you have. They know that you are talking to somebody about those things, but they cannot bear the weight of hearing every single detail about that particular struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's the better, more loving thing to find those people who really you can depend on to be able to call with every struggle and with every moment, you know. And it's like, it's really good. So don't wrap all that up into one person too. I think a lot of people say, yeah, but I'm so close to my spouse, that's all I need. That's great. It is. I'm not being facetious, but that can't be your only person, because there will be things that will be so hard to share because of how it might bear upon that relationship, that you need to have other people for the sustenance of that relationship that you are sharing more than you're sharing there. You really need to have that. Even if that other person just knows you're talking to somebody about it, it's wildly, wildly important. And so it just takes that risk of saying, I'm going to intentionally, you know, if I haven't been found out about something that makes it where people are going to have to know everything about me that are the worst things, I'm going to intentionally go and tell those things to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not a thing anyone really rationally chooses to do. But if you're smart, you know, it's like when you're learning to play guitar, your first, you know, few months, your fingers are going to hurt and they're going to bleed and it's going to be really horrible. But you're not going to be able to be a good guitar player unless you go through the initial pain of that, because what happens on the other side is you build up these calluses on your fingers and it makes you a great guitar player, because now you can play and it doesn't hurt anymore because you prepped well.
Mm-hmm.
The way that you prep well for hard times is by, you know, the pain and the blood of choosing. You choose it so that you're well prepared and you're not, as I was, under-resourced for hard times, because people already know all the worst, and so they're there and you know they're not going to leave you. And those few friends are not shocked, and you know that they're ready to come up around you, or are you up around them. And it just takes intentionally doing it, and that's a really hard thing to do. But it's kind of the only choice you have. And if you don't do it, God forbid, as a result of your not having done it, something does blow up and now everyone knows. Now you'll be forced into relationships like that. You might as well choose it.
Do it ahead of time. Yeah, man, that is so helpful. Derek, I'm going to let you go, and I will just leave you with this. You're a man that has taught me for many years now, from, you know, listening as a Christian teenager to Caveman's Call and loving all your Dove Awards, you know, that you won back then, to just following your music. But the two things about your solo career have been grace and truth. Those are the two things that you have taught me. And taught me how to do as a leader is grace, and what grace really looks like, and truth, and what truth really looks like. So I want to thank you for those two things, and thanks so much for the conversation today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, man. It's good to talk to you.
What you hear playing in the background is the song A Savior on Capitol Hill by Derek Webb from the Ringing Bell album. This is a song I love to refer people to during election season. I didn't get a chance to ask Derek about this in the interview, just for time's sake, so I want to make sure I leave you with this. I have a couple blogs I have done that are inspired by this song. When we get into political season like we are right now, and everyone thinks that this politician is going to save the world, and they start evangelizing that politician, this song is a great reminder that we'll never have a savior on Capitol Hill. well, the only Savior we have is Jesus, and we need to orient our church lives accordingly. So I'll let you listen to it in the background, and then at the end of the podcast, which will be wrapping up here in a couple minutes, I'll reset the song and play it at full volume so you can listen to it in its entirety. But what I encourage you to do as a way of just thanking Derek for the interview and just connecting with him is check out his website. It's derekweb.com. And what's really amazing about Derek, he's a co-founder of Noise Trade. Noise Trade is a very large music distribution, I guess you'd call it, website. And what's unique about it is all the music is free. There's plenty of bands on there that you've heard of, bands and artists and others, many that you haven't heard of. But you download the music for free. It's all legal. And then you can tip the artist if you'd like to, and you don't have to either. It's a very cool music community. And all Derek's music, not all of his music, almost all of his music is there. So go to noisetrade.com and look up Derek, or you can do that at his website with a lot of other great stuff at his website as well. And finally, in closing, as always, I encourage you to go check out my blog, which is at acrossroads.net. And I will link this episode there. I'll have all the links that we've been talking about throughout the episode. And with that, I will see you next time behind the curtain and at a crossroads. I'm so tired of these mortal men with their hands on their wallets and their hearts. And scared of their friends, and they're always running for re-election. So come to D.C. if it be thy will, because we've never had a savior on Capitol Hill. Well, you can always trust the devil or a politician to be the devil.